Welcome to the Clinical Research Coach Podcast. I'm your host, Leanne Wolke. In this podcast, we bridge conversations between industry, thought leaders, and patients. Utilizing a unique perspective, integrating years of coaching with Tony Robbins, coupled with scientific and industry experience, we have vulnerable and real conversations with the goal of impacting the industry in meaningful ways. Daniel A. Perez is a self-proclaimed rebel in clinical research. An advocate for patient diversity, equity, and inclusion, he's the director and global head of patient experience, diversity, and inclusion at Worldwide Clinical Trials. He's also a board member and chair of operations for Clinical Trials in Color Foundation, as well as the co-founder of Coalition for Advancing Research Equity, or CARE. He's been a speaker at many events and held a variety of positions, ranging from research program manager at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, a clinical research manager at Children's Hospital LA, and the chief executive officer and board member at Macro Trials. So Daniel, welcome to the podcast. Let's start out. Tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get to where you are today?
Oh man, I think like most of us, we just fell into it by accident. It wasn't a deliberate career path. We were talking a moment ago about restlessness, and there was a series of restless moments when I first started off at Cedars-Sinai back in 2009, just doing clerical admin work, super entry level. And along the way, it was hey, I want to learn something new. I want to take on something more challenging. And you know, folks along the way, like my mentors, were always throwing, you know, different complex projects at me. And one thing led to the next. And one day I found myself stumbling into clinical research. And I know that sounds overly simplified, as you know, but along the way there, right, there's a whole journey to the discovery of clinical research as a field. And I think over the course of time, I realized that I have great people skills. I enjoy working with patients. I didn't want to be a clinician, couldn't be on my feet for 12 hours. And so I found that the right balance was working on the units with patients, enrolling patients. So then I found myself leaving Cedars. I went to Children's Hospital, where I felt like the mission was a lot more aligned, sense of purpose. Walking through the hospital and seeing kids really does something in terms of reminding you what you're doing day in and day out. So that mission was very personal and important to me. And I found myself just kind of bored and wanting to do more and wanting to create more and architect more. And when you're at a very established institution or hospital, you don't really get that leeway. And, you know, there may be folks who definitely supported and believed in the change that I wanted to push forward, but that takes time. And eventually I found my way over to engaging with the founders of Macro Trials, where I spent the last 4 years. And yeah, I went pursuing that because it was like a kid in a candy store. I can use all of my skills stack. I can create whatever I wanted to create. And I had a group of amazing physicians that were creatives, and they wanted to do the right thing. They wanted to get patients into studies and support research and not move as slow as some of these large institutions do. And what brought me to Macro was the work. It was the mission of supporting these trials. And we did a lot of rare disease clinical research. And we must have scored great wins. Eventually, at some point, we did grow quite rapidly. And coming through the pandemic, the company was excited to position itself as a, you know, getting the name on the map, having done some great work and getting some attention with institutional funding. And so as I come to close with my Macro chapter, it was the perfect kind of transition. You know, the timing just felt right. It was time for the company to kind of go off to college, and I'll be an empty nester. And that's kind of how my involvement, you know, into this particular point in time has been.
So talk to me a little bit about, you know, helping Macro Trials become so successful. As you probably have seen some of the data around there's this huge number of PIs who only participate in one trial and never again. They hop in and they're like, no way, I'm out. What do you think contributes to that?
So many layers. It's like an onion, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the original intent, I would think, and based off of the doctors I've had the pleasure to work with over the years to pursue medicine, is that Hippocratic oath. It is to uphold and to care for patients and to be the one to deliver medicine and healing. As their career progresses, we realize that it is increasingly difficult to get through the college graduation, a medical college residency, fellowship. And then you get there and you realize you've got a couple of restrictive choices. You oftentimes have to pick and choose between, do I want stability and being able to have financial security and pay off my student loans and medical school loans? And if that's the case, you pursue working in a healthcare system, or you pursue, you know, working in a larger practice. And then if you want to go the entrepreneurial route and create your own practice, you go at risk and you have to work an extremely large number of hours and you have to have an extremely heavy workload. At which point are you really living? And so physicians are tired and they're burnt out and they want the same thing that you and I want. They want to spend time with their families. They want to travel the world. They don't want to give their entire lives per se to medicine. And of course, you work in a large health system, you are given more of an opportunity to participate in clinical research, but it's so incredibly difficult and slow to move trials from when a pharma company identifies the physician to when you actually can start to enroll, right? So more often than not in my career, I noticed fellows and physicians who are more junior kind of peripherally get involved with clinical research, but never as the principal investigator. It's always the sub-investigator or the more glamorous co-investigator title that you see, but never the PI role, because the PI role in these hospitals is reserved for the more senior academic physicians, the chairman of the department. And so they don't ever get to fully, you know, understand what that realm is. Then you look at those in private practice, and it is incredibly daunting to understand from A through Z budgeting and contracting and regulatory and IRB submissions. And how do I start this up? And what am I going to, you know, how am I going to support this? So when you go through that process and you realize there's a lot of already kind of workload complexity to these physicians, then you add a little bit more burden to kind of keep it nicely stated. And being able to differentiate who is the who, the CRO versus pharma versus site activation versus I'm your document specialist versus I'm your budgets and contract specialist. And just there's so much. And then you undergo all of that. Mm-hmm. And somehow your PI, who is so willing and committed to going through all of that, they do so. And they're excited to get their patients in the trial. And they start getting protocol deviations, or they get monitoring visits, and nobody really kind of is able to support them in that learning curve of, hey, look, these things tend to happen. It's not the end of the world. Let's walk through it. Let's support you through it. Let's make sure you kind of are able to have adequate oversight. And then that tends to kind of give you analysis paralysis as a physician. You're like, I don't want to protocol deviation. That sounds really bad. Like, I don't want to do that. Or this was too burdensome, or I couldn't get paid. You know, that we were supposed to be net 45. It's been a year. I don't know who to go invoice. So there's a lot to unpack, even in all of those layers, right?
Mm-hmm. And so how do we, you know, what's the answer? If you could say the three things that would make a difference to those investigators that aren't continuing on or would make a difference to the sites, what would they be?
Well, I think being able to have like a micro educational string of just quick bursts of what are the essential PI, you know, responsibilities. Of course, you're asking for a lot of substantial code of federal regulation to be consolidated and what that means for the FDA, right? I don't mean to oversimplify the heavy and the gravity of the responsibility. And at the same time, do we expect our physicians to understand that full breath? Like, really, how do we distill that down to what's needed for them? That's number one. The second thing is, you need your research coordinators, and you need an education and orientation around, first of all, who are they? What do they do? How do they differ from administrative staff? And why are they so critical? And I think pharma and or CROs who want to engage research naive physicians for the first time, we've got to be resource conscious. Yes, your physician may have an established practice, or they may be, you know, in practice a number of years, but they also don't understand the level of expertise that they need in a study coordinator. So we need some support and orientation in that arena. And I think the third thing is being able to really take a hard look at all the platforms and the different technologies that you're expecting your site to use. Are you using eCOAs or wearables? Do you have tablets for questionnaires? Really think about how to customize your offering around the ecosystem of that physician. Really integrate this trial into their environment, because at the end of the day, you want that physician to be successful, enroll patients, and do it in a compliant manner, and also do it rather quickly. It's not, you know, sometimes it's not access to the patient per se. Oftentimes it may just be the layers and barriers that you have kind of just built into what it means to execute the trial. They're just preventing your patients from being enrolled. So those would be the three things, really, is just the educational support, making it digestible. I would say orientation to this type of staff and team that you need. And then, you know, being a resource upfront with the CRO or pharma. If I'm paying the site and this is the PI's first trial, I'm going to be more generous with that site activation fee because they need to pay for the study coordinators. I want to be involved with that, right?
Great points. You know, and I think I was having a conversation with another person from a site earlier, and they were talking about, you know, sometimes they're asked to log into 7+ different systems for one trial. And they're like, oh my gosh, you know, or they'll have a PI who's not tech savvy, fantastic with patients, but not tech savvy. And now we're asking them to embrace technology that might be cumbersome or bulky or intrusive.
And I'll say, really looking at the question from the lens of empathy, what I've learned is a lot of physicians, I'm not going to overgeneralize, but a lot of the physicians I've worked with takes a good year and a half, maybe 2 years, to develop trust, even just clinical research coordinator or ancillary staff and physician. Why do I touch on that? I touch on it because physicians that come through residency and fellowship, and it's like one day they're out on their own, that's very scary, because the same way that we all grapple with imposter syndrome or am I doing enough, or am I doing a great job? Physicians are humans too. They're not excluded from that type of emotional heaviness around, hey, these patients are entrusting their lives with me. And so you imagine you spend your entire last how many years getting through to the fellowship finish line. Now you got to be involved in clinical research. My immediate reaction to something that is so foreign and complex looking and scary sounding is to say, no, I don't have time for it. That's like the most immediate, you know, knee jerk. I just don't have time for it. Right. Folks will rarely admit that I'm going to say no because I have a fear of failure. I have a fear of not excelling at it. I have a fear of doing it and my reputation is going to be tarnished because I didn't know how to do it. And what's more important is I don't want you to know that I have got discomfort in not doing it well, right? So there's that element of it. So if you kind of infuse that trust building with the relationship, it goes a very long way.
Yeah. And you speak about the relationship, and I think that that's so important, you know, with the staff, but also there's almost become, I don't want to say adversarial, but like a bit of an adversarial relationship between sites, CROs, sponsors. How do we get everybody on the same team?
That's an important question. I think There are a number of incentives and elements that influence the different streams of, I'll say it like this, excitement or enthusiasm or passion in our colleagues and partners at the pharma level, at the CRO level, and at the site level. At the end of the day, I think fundamentally, we as human beings, we want to do well. We want to have a sense of belonging. We want to have a sense of being received. We want to have a sense of being seen. That's a very fundamental human need, is love. And really getting into the mushiness of it, right?
You're speaking my language, Daniel.
Yeah, a lot of us are drawn into the life sciences because we're type A, because we're perfectionists, because we excelled in school. And so it just kind of, there's a selection bias to who has been attracted to this crucible. And I say crucible because this is human, like this is people these are people suffering. So there's infused elements of mission with disease and the therapeutic areas and the want to support drug development. And then there's personality. And that can kind of just form crusts on the outermost layer, really making us either forget or disconnect with what we truly wanted. And that was to have a sense of belonging. And I think for our ecosystem, CRO, patient, pharma, physicians, when we kind of just align and orient and realizing that, hey, we are, none of us are exempt from growing older, becoming ill, and meeting our own, you know, demise at some point. None of us are, regardless of title, socioeconomic background. There's nothing that we have, unless we have figured something else out, we're not exempt from that. And I think when we realize that the patients that we're impacting are our moms, they're our brothers, our siblings, cousins, our aunts, our grandparents, we can quickly reorient to this is about people and this is about caring for humans. And hey, guess what? I can be that patient tomorrow. You can be that patient tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. And there's nothing more fulfilling than when, you know, the other day I was at a hotel and I was watching a TV commercial and it was a Novartis product. And I immediately texted my friend because about 5 years ago, she worked on that trial. Mm. And I remember what that was like. I remember the patient recruitment struggles. And I remember patients in the clinic, you know, being upset because they wanted to participate or because this was their only, you know, access to care. So really the antidote is understanding that any kind of, I guess, animosity or adversarial type of mentality, it tends to come from, I don't know if I'm doing a good job, or I don't know if I can be doing the best that I can. And so we tend to like realize that, oh, maybe we're attacking each other. We're not in the same team. And honestly, that's not what it is, right? It's about how do we come back into a space of trust?
So that's a great question. You know, I think I've been on some projects with some crazy tight timelines. And, you know, some very serious indications. And with those, I think I always kept top of mind what I was doing, you know, and you've talked a couple times about purpose driven and yes, really keeping that purpose. So do you have a specific personal purpose in all of this?
You know, when I was about probably 3 or 4 years old, there are home videos of me running around my living room with a towel wrapped around my neck because I had seen on TV, not Superman, a doctor on a TV commercial. And my mom tells the story of like, yeah, you'd run around and find whatever you can, like baby powder and baby oil. And you're always making these elixirs and you're always telling your aunts to sit here and I'm going to rub you there and put this on you and do that, you know, and whatever. And I remember kind of getting older, I think I must have been like about 10 when we had a family member at Cedars-Sinai. It was the first time I stepped in a hospital. And when the elevators opened, there was a doctor in real life and there was nurses in that elevator. And I was just blown, like, these are my heroes. And I just knew that at such a young age, couldn't really put a finger on it. As I advanced through that, probably it was in late 2008, I began my Buddhist practice, which is probably what you see back here, my space. Uh-huh. And I started to understand more about being mission driven and kind of how we all tend to find the right chord that synchronizes and harmonizes us into our day-to-day life. And that's when I realized that it was the healing arts. Now, that's a concept that I learned in my Buddhist practice, is the healing arts. Well, in Western society, it's about life science, and science cannot, you know, coexist with the artistic, and the kind of, there's a separation of being cerebral versus being creative, especially in evidence-based medicine and clinical research. Mm-hmm. So when I heard the term healing arts, something clicked. There is an art, there's a craft to it. There's a mastery, there's an art, you know what I'm saying? Like, this doesn't just happen because you went to an Ivy League school and you had training from, you know, a world-renowned clinician. That's not where the, you know, it's like taking a sword and you're like pounding it in the heat. And this sword is your craft. You're not going to take it out of the heat the first time and it's going to be polished and perfect. So there's a craftsmanship there. And so I thought that the calling was to be a doctor. And then I realized I couldn't sit there and not sit with patients. I care too much about them. Not to say that physicians don't, but they don't have that level of time to really kind of sit bedside. Yeah. And then I thought, well, maybe nursing. And then I realized, well, again, 12-hour shift rotations, you're charting. You don't really, as much as you may want to sit and have that connection, you can't. So existential crisis later, I'm like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do because the healing arts, what else can I do? Mm-hmm. And that's how I wound up in clinical research. And I realized now that this is where the sense of mission comes from.
Now talk to me about your new role and being the global head of patient experience, diversity, and inclusion. Tell me why that's important right now.
It's critical. I think that as we come out of this COVID-19 space with a lot of conversation and excitement around hybrid trials, decentralized trials, virtual trials, the trailblazers over at Science 37, who really kind of brought that into the mainstream awareness. I think more and more we're creating access, and we're creating access to a very specific type of patient. And I think what's important is understanding that there is a difference between creating access to patients from a recruitment strategy standpoint. And we see CVS and Walgreens kind of dominating that kind of that space in that conversation. And also flipping that and saying, well, what does patient access to clinical trials look like? They're not the same. Mm. Because one would imply that they are being approached, and the other one would imply that they have an awareness to and can access it equitably wherever they're at, whether or not they want to welcome the clinical research team into their home, or whether they prefer to go to a brick and mortar, or anywhere in between that. And so for me, kind of stepping out of macro and coming into the now what space, am I going to take up knitting? Am I going to crochet? Am I, like, what is my hobby going to be? I was incredibly blessed and fortunate to have great colleagues who brought me into the folds and said, well, what do you want to do? I'm not sure. Somewhere in the intersection of clin ops, because the continuity down to trial, startup, and execution is critical. At the intersection of patient engagement strategy, at the intersection of sales and business development, because I need pharma to see the big picture and realize the value, and we got to get buy-in from them. And also we see the FDA releasing guidance, and we're seeing them release more and more formality around the conversation of equity and inclusion and diversity. And so it's kind of like, how do we align that? And that's the right type of challenge that I've always gotten so squirmy and excited, is when there's layers and complexity to the problem and to the challenge. And it's like a Rubik's cube, you know, you kind of just have to click and fix and click and fix. And one day just things align. And I don't know whether that's going to be in a year, in 2 years, in 5 or 20, but you can't let that discourage you, because you've got to start somewhere. And I don't ever claim to be an expert. I don't ever claim to be, you know, anything more than just a student. That's all I've ever been, and that's all I'll ever be. And so that's my hope about this role that I'm stepping into. I'm incredibly excited. And again, the future of health equity really depends on what we do here today and how we work together.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time. I think we could sit here and talk for a couple hours. So we might have to do a part two here.
Of course.
But I love that you're so mission driven. I appreciate that. And I can't wait to see what you do in this new role. And, you know, as you continue to look at this and impact people through the healing arts in your own unique way, but also bring your sense of empathy and heart to the teams that get to interact with you.
Yes, thank you. That's honestly a lot of fulfilling parts of clinical research. And some of the most fulfilling ones have been with my team, the teams that I've developed, the team members who they don't want to take their best stab at it because they feel like they can't, or it's so daunting, or I don't think I can do this. And I always tell my team, this is the saying that I always start every new team member with. I tell them, you've got wings and I want you to use them. Mm. And before you realize that your wings are there, you're going to be flying one day. And I know you think I'm crazy, or that it's not possible, or what are you talking about? Well, one day when you're mid-flight, you're going to look down and I'll be waving at you. And that is my job, is to develop you. The most fulfilling moments have been those, in addition to, right? So I look forward to seeing what the future has.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Yes. And, thank you. You too, Leanne. Thank you for the invitation. This was awesome.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Clinical Research Coach. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you'd subscribe and leave a rating and a review. I truly hope that you got something out of this episode that can help us all work towards our goal of making a meaningful difference in the lives of others.